I'm Nikki Strong, and this is VOA 1 The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. On the show today, I have a report about artwork made for government spaces and places in America. Then, Faith Perlow is on time to present this week's Ask a Teacher. After her report, Faith joins me in the studio to answer a few more questions. And we close the show with an American story. But first, here's John Russell.
The same area where the Wright brothers developed the first airplane will soon see electric planes that take off and land vertically. The planes, called flying taxis, will be produced under an agreement between the state of Ohio and Joby Aviation at Dayton International Airport. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine told the Associated Press, "When you're talking about air taxis, that's the future." Around the world, electric vehicle takeoff and landing, or eVTOL, aircraft, or flying taxis, are becoming more common. Still, questions remain about noise levels and charging demands. Developers say the planes are nearing the day when they will provide a way to move individual people or small groups from the top of buildings and parking spaces to their destinations. The Wright brothers, Orville and Wilbur, lived and worked in Dayton, Ohio. In 1910, they opened the first U.S. airplane factory there. To connect with this history, Joby's official announcement Monday took place at Orville Wright's home, Hawthorne Hill, and ended with a special flight of a copy of the Wright Model B flyer. Engineers designed Joby's production aircraft to transport a pilot and four passengers at speeds of up to 321.87 kilometers per hour. The aircraft can cover a distance of up to 160.93 kilometers. It is a quiet machine that can barely be heard in most cities, the company said. The plan is to place them in aerial ride-sharing networks beginning in 2025. Joby Aviation is a 14-year-old company that went public in 2021 and became the first eVTOL firm to receive a special kind of permission, or certification, from the U.S. Air Force. Its production efforts are supported by partnerships with Toyota, Delta Airlines, Intel, and Uber. The $500 million project is supported by up to $325 million in payments from the state of Ohio. With the money, Joby plans to build an Ohio facility capable of delivering up to 500 aircraft a year and creating 2,000 jobs. The U.S. Department of Energy has invited Joby to apply for a loan to support development of the facility as a clean energy project. Joby CEO Joe Ben Bevert told the AP that the company chose Ohio after a large and competitive search. Ohio's financial deal was not the largest, but the chance to bring the operation to the birthplace of aviation, with a workforce experienced in the field, led to the deal, he said. The announcement comes as a group of Ohio's congressional representatives has recently increased efforts to draw the U.S. Air Force's new U.S. Space Command headquarters, or Space Force units, to Ohio. There, too, state leaders point to the history of the Wrights, as well as Ohio-born astronauts John Glenn and Neil Armstrong. I'm John Russell.
Artwork has been a part of federal structures almost since the founding of the United States. A good example is the U.S. Capitol building, with its domed ceiling, paintings, and statues, and the Washington Monument, to honor the nation's first president, was completed in 1888. Jennifer Gibson is the director of the Center for Fine Arts at the General Services Administration, GSA, the agency that supervises federal buildings. She says art in federal buildings is a record of the past and creates a dynamic presence in towns and cities and border stations across the country. In the 1960s, a presidential committee stated that fine art should be incorporated into the designs of federal buildings, with emphasis on the work of living American artists. Today, the government still spends about 0.5% of the federal budget to commission or order new artwork for federal spaces. The commissions are decided by a group that includes the lead designer of the building, those who will occupy the space, community members, arts professionals, and the GSA. Artists are given details about the building project and asked to propose artwork they think is best for the space. New York artist James Carpenter created two artworks for federal buildings. They included a ceiling for a courtroom in Phoenix, Arizona, and a sculpture for another courthouse in Salt Lake City, Utah. Carpenter said, "My work is really about how to enhance or influence, in a very positive way, people's experience of spaces." For some artists, requests to provide art for federal buildings may not be related to making money. Artists can make commissions as much as $1 million from non-government artworks. The average commission for art in federal buildings is around $100,000. And the process can take several years, limiting an artist's ability to work on other art projects. Carpenter said the Salt Lake City project took a total of 12 years. They're looking at it as a way to participate in what's going on in the nation and to be part of its history, Gibson says. This is for the nation. This is permanent. We will take care of it. And it's your way to participate. The commissioned artworks can be found in 428 federal buildings across the country. Overall, the GSA's fine art collection contains 26,712 works, including some that date back to the 1850s. Most of the artworks are paintings, sculptures, and photographs created in the 1930s. The collection belongs to the American people as a record of the history of American culture.
This week on Ask a Teacher, we will answer a question about the difference between in time and on time. Dear VOA, what is the difference between in time and on time? I appreciate that you can help me understand them. I'm looking forward to seeing your answer. Have a great day. Nguyen. Thanks for this great question, Nguyen. Both on time and in time have to do with being punctual and deadlines. Sometimes people use these expressions interchangeably, but they are different. And end time has a few more uses. Let's look at each one. On time is an expression that includes a preposition, on, and a noun, time. If something is on time, it arrives at or by an exact time or deadline. It is not late. You can think of on time as when something happens. And if it happens at that exact time, then it is on time. Jordan did not submit her homework on time, so she received 5 points off. The train is always on time, so I am never late to work. Let's move on to in time. In time is also an expression that includes a preposition, in, and the noun, time. Like on time, it is used to talk about deadlines and times. It means early enough or not too late for something to happen. Often we use it to talk about something in relation to another event or thing using another preposition, for, after the expression. Even though my train was late, I got to work in time for the meeting. We made it home in time to watch our favorite show. In time is also used two other ways. In music, in time means to keep a rhythm or speed. The tap dancer was able to keep time with the musicians. And in time also means eventually. We use it to describe the passage of time and something happening in the future. In time, the leaves will turn bright colors as autumn settles in. The medicine will start to work and you will feel better in time. Please let us know if these explanations and examples have helped you, Nguyen. Do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard this week's Ask a Teacher. And now, Teacher Faith is here to talk about her report. Welcome back to the show, Faith.
Thanks, Katie. This week we had a question about in time and on time.
Prepositions can be difficult for learners, but your explanation of the differences was clear. On time is used for exact times and deadlines. In time means early enough or not too late for something to happen.
That's right. But remember that in time also has other uses.
Oh, that's right. You said it means to keep a rhythm or speed. Could you explain more about in time and its connection to music?
Of course. I am a dancer and not a musician, but this is what I understand of it. In time connects to a few ideas in music. This includes the rhythm, or music's pattern in time, and the tempo, or speed at which the music is played, how fast or how slow it is. The rhythmic pattern in music is expressed by the time signature. Those are the two numbers in the beginning of a piece of music. For example, like 4-4 time, 7-8 time, or even 9-8 time.
What do those two numbers mean?
The top number is the beats per measure in the music, and the bottom number tells you what kind of notes the beats are. Like quarter notes are represented by the number 4, and eighth notes would be 8.
So, if someone plays in a certain time, will they know how many beats and the kind of notes to play?
Yes. For example, John played the piano in waltz time. John would know the time signature is 3-4, 3 beats per measure, and the quarter note gets the beat. So it sounds like 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. That is 3-4 time or waltz time.
Thanks for that timely English lesson, Faith. It was music to my ears.
You're welcome, Katie. Talk to you soon.
And now, the Learning English Program, American Stories.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 4.
In the afternoon, the man came to a track. It was that of another man who did not walk, but who dragged himself on his hands and knees. The man thought it might be Bill, but he thought about it without any interest. He had no curiosity. Feeling and emotion had left him. He was no longer able to feel pain, yet the life that was in him drove him ahead. He was very tired, but it refused to die. It was because it refused to die that he still ate muskeg berries and small fish, drank his hot water, and kept a careful eye on the sick wolf. He followed the track of the other man who dragged himself along. Soon he came to the end of it. There were a few freshly cleaned bones where the grass was marked by the footprints of many wolves. He saw a moose-skin bag, exactly like his own. It had been torn by sharp teeth. He picked it up, although its weight was almost too much for his weak fingers. Bill had carried it to the end. Now he would have the last laugh. He would live and carry it to the ship in the shining sea. He laughed aloud, making an inhuman sound, and the sick wolf howled with him. The man ceased suddenly. How could he laugh at Bill, if that were Bill? If those bones, so pinky white and clean, were Bill? He turned away. Bill had deserted him, but he would not take the gold, nor would he eat Bill's bones. Bill would have done so, however, had their situations been exchanged. He came to a pool of water. Bending over it in search of fish, he threw his head back as if he had been struck. He had caught sight of his face in the water. So awful was it that his feelings were stirred long enough to be shocked. There were 3 fish in the pool, which was too large to empty. After several attempts to catch them in his tin container, he stopped. He was afraid, because of his great weakness, that he might fall and sink into the water. It was for this reason, too, that he did not trust himself to ride down the river atop one of the many logs to be found along its banks. That day he lessened the distance between him and the ship by 3 miles. The next day he traveled only 2 miles. because he was now dragging himself on his hands and knees as Bill had done. At the end of the fifth day, the ship was still 7 miles away. He was unable to travel as much as a mile a day. However, the summer weather continued, and he continued to move toward the ship. And always the sick wolf coughed at his heels. His knees had become red meat like his feet. Although he bound them with the shirt from his back, it was a red track he left behind him on the grass and stones. Once, glancing back, he saw the wolf licking his bloody track hungrily. He saw clearly what his own end might be, unless he could kill the wolf. Then began as awful an event as has ever been told. Two sick creatures, dragging their dying bodies across a wasteland and hunting each other's lives. Had it been a well wolf, it would not have mattered so much to the man. But the thought of feeding the mouth of that nearly dead thing was hateful. His mind had begun to wander again, and he was troubled by hallucinations. His reasonable moments grew shorter. He was awakened once from a faint sleep by a cough close to his ear. The wolf leaped back, losing its footing and falling in its weakness. It was a funny sight, but he could not laugh. Nor was he afraid. He was too far gone for that. But his mind was, for the moment, clear, and he lay and considered. The ship was no more than 4 miles away. He could see it quite well when he rubbed his eyes. He could also see the white sail of a small boat cutting the water of the shining sea. But he could never drag himself those 4 miles. He knew that, and was very calm about the fact. He knew that he could not travel another half a mile, and yet he wanted to live. It was unreasonable that he should die after all he had been through. Fate asked too much of him. And dying, he could not accept death. It was madness, perhaps. But in the very grasp of death, he refused to die. He closed his eyes and tried to keep himself calm. He struggled against the awful desire for sleep that threatened him. It was much like a sea, this deadly sleepiness. It rose and rose, mastering his entire self bit by bit. Sometimes he was almost lost, swimming through its waters with a weakening effort. Then, by some strange power of the soul, his will would strike out more strongly against it. Without movement, he lay on his back. He could hear slowly drawing nearer and nearer the sound of the sick wolf's breathing. It came closer, always closer. And he did not move. It was beside his ear. The dry tongue moved across his face. His hands struck out. Actually, he had willed them to strike out. The fingers were curved, but they closed on empty air. Quickness requires strength, and the man had not his strength. The quiet waiting of the wolf was awful. The man's waiting was no less awful. For half a day he lay without motion, fighting off sleep. He waited for the thing that was to feed upon him, and upon which he wished to feed. Sometimes the sea of sleep rose over him, and he dreamed long dreams. But always through it all, waking and dreaming, he waited for the noisy breath and the feel of the tongue. This time he did not hear the breath. He slipped slowly from some dream to feel the tongue along his hand. He waited. The teeth pressed softly, then more firmly. The wolf was using its last strength in an effort to sink its teeth into the food for which it had waited so long. But the man, too, had waited long. The hand closed on the wolf's mouth. Slowly, while the wolf struggled weakly, the other hand moved across the wolf's body. 5 minutes later, the whole weight of the man's body was on top of the wolf. The hands had not sufficient strength to grasp the wolf about the throat until it died, but the face of the man was pressed close to the throat of the wolf, and the mouth of the man was full of hair. At the end of half an hour, the man felt some warm drops of blood in his throat. It was not pleasant. It was like hot, melted metal being forced into his stomach, and it was forced by his will alone. Later, the man rolled on his back and slept. There were some scientists traveling on the fishing ship Bedford. From where they stood on the ship, they could see a strange object on the shore. It was moving down the beach toward the water. They were unable to decide what it was. Being men of science, they climbed into a smaller boat and went ashore to examine it. And they saw something that was alive, but which could hardly be called a man. It was blind and did not know what it was doing. Its movements produced little effect, but still it continued to drag itself across the ground at the rate of about 20 feet an hour. 3 weeks later, the man lay in a bed on the fishing boat. With tears streaming down his face, he told who he was and what he had experienced. He also talked without meaning about his mother and a home in California among the flowers. The days were not many after that, when he sat at table with the scientists and the ship's officers. He delighted in the sight of so much food, and watched it carefully as it went into the mouths of others. With the disappearance of each mouthful, an expression of sorrow came into his eyes. He was not mad, however. He hated those men at mealtimes. He was afraid that there would not be enough food. He inquired of the cook, the cabin boy, the captain, concerning the food supply. They reassured him numerous times, but he would not believe them, and went into the kitchen to see with his own eyes. It was noticed that the man was getting fat. He grew bigger with each day. The scientists shook their heads and gave their opinions on the problem. They limited the amount of food given to the man at his meals, but still his weight increased. The seamen smiled. They knew. And when the scientists decided to observe the man, they learned the reason. They saw him walk about the ship after breakfast. Like a man begging with an outstretched hand, he approached a seaman. The seaman smiled and gave him a piece of bread. He grasped it and looked at it as a greedy man looks at gold. Then he put it inside his shirt. He received similar gifts from other smiling seamen. The scientists were careful. They allowed him to continue. But they secretly examined his bed. It was lined with bread. Every inch of space was filled with bread. Yet he was not mad. He was preparing for another possible famine, that was all. He would recover from it, the scientist said. And he did, even before the Bedford sailed into San Francisco Bay.
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm